Sammy Kotovic is actually our next speaker, and he's a PhD candidate and adjunct professor at Temple University's Department of Religion. He's also a practicing attorney in the state of New Jersey and a member of New Jersey's Muslim Attorneys Association. Besides practicing law and his academic activity, Sammy is involved with the American Muslim Community Organizations. He's the East Coast representative of the Executive Council of ISNA, Islamic Society of North America. And he is currently the executive director of the New Brunswick Islamic Center. So please join me in welcoming Sammy.
Thank you. It's really an honor and to be here with you all here this evening. Unfortunately, I didn't have the privilege of being through all the sessions as I was preoccupied with previous engagements. Much of what I was going to say was already covered, so this actually leaves my job a little bit easier, and hopefully then my comments even briefer. The previous presenters have done a fantastic job at outlining the issues of the question. So what I wanted to do maybe is to just highlight a couple of things that I think should be considered and looked at that may be overlooked. And beginning, I guess, first with the notion when we're talking about here of alternatives, the way the question is posed and sometimes the way these discussions take place is that there are several alternatives and we're seeking the better of the alternatives. And I think when it comes to the issue of drones, we have to be categorical as religious leaders that is not an acceptable alternative for any type of military intervention or such. So while we may use statistics and evidence of its ineffectiveness, that should never trump, that may be a tactic we use in terms of argumentation, it should never trump the principle upon which we base our position. Similar to the way we deal with torture, for example. Right, Nirkat, you know, with ISNA was one of the signatories, and Reverend Kilmer, active with that, and putting that together, it's a principled position. So yes, you can show how torture is ineffective and how it, you know, in the statistics that show that. But regardless of whether it's effective or not, it's a position that we're not willing to permit as an alternative: nuclear weapons, chemical weapons. Right, we can sit there and actually show, plenty have, of the benefits of nuclear weapons and Nagasaki and Hiroshima and how many U.S. lives were saved, etc. That there was actually, statistically, it could have been actually, it was beneficial if we do it purely based on cost-benefit analysis. But that should not be our position as religious leaders. We have to maintain that principled position. So I think we should just be careful that we don't lose sight of that. The second, maybe obvious but overlooked issue, and I think that we have to be also clear about in terms of when we're talking to lawmakers and others, and I think this was touched on a little bit earlier, but just to highlight this, we're dealing with human beings. We speak in ISIS, we speak about Al-Qaeda, we speak about Al-Shabaab as if these are things. And the problem is, what ends up happening is, we as human beings cannot really engage things. You can't really engage organizations. You can engage human beings. And so if we construct our understanding of this, that these aren't things, but they are made up of human beings, yes, some of them doing the most atrocious subhuman actions, we take the discourse into a discourse dealing with behavior of human beings. What are the motivations of human beings? And we're touching on that in the various presentations today. Why are people moving toward these extremist positions to begin with? It's looking at their behavior. What is the motivations upon that? So I think that is one thing we should also keep in mind. And just to give you an example, I mean, you know, if we're looking at ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, whatever you want to call it, much of its upper leadership, we're finding out more and more now, is actually ex-Saddam, right? Ba'ath Party senior heads who are actually the upper circle of the advisors and the ones running the affairs. And if you know anything, obviously, about the Ba'ath Party, it was anything but Islamic. It had everything to do with opposing any type of Islam, religious practice under Saddam's regime. It was a nationalist movement. But what was it? They're human beings. Yes, sick human beings. What did they do? Human beings move toward positions of power if they were in positions of power. So now it's ISIS is in power. Now all of a sudden they're Islamists. Right? So it's looking at behavior. There, if that's what you're dealing with, it's not really necessarily ideologically based. This goes to now looking at these groups, which I think was also touched upon. One of the things that I think you will find, and even I find in terms of just dealing with religious leaders in my faith community in the United States, is that very few tend to be hardcore ideologues. And so although I think one of the slides had showed in Somalia, it was extremely high ideology being a motivating force. I think if you actually look to it, even look a little further other than a person, it was that self-identification, that it was that you will find that in fact that's probably not really the case. That people are not necessarily extremist ideologues. They are, again, due to human behavior or human motivation, they move into those areas for some reason or another. So I think if any type of policy or any type of program that we are seeking to try to address these issues that are bringing people over, we should be focusing on that group, not the hardcore ideologues, because at the end of the day, if there are the hardcore ideologue, they're probably not going to be convinced. But if you can put their call upon deaf ears in their own societies and communities, right, that will marginalize them within their societies rather than giving them strength and power. What are the general motivations that you find within or pulling people in? You know, the obvious, it's interesting that the ones that the United States, that we as a nation are fighting, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, etc., they've come to realize something that for some reason our government fails to understand. If we look at any of these groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, etc., what is their support base? The ideologues are there, yes, at the core and at the top. But why are they so popular? Because of their social programs. Their extensive social programs. Most of the Lebanese and the Shia aren't necessarily ideologically bent. They weren't bought on the propaganda of Hezbollah. In ISIS, it's the same thing. You're seeing this. Why is it expanding so rapidly? The first thing ISIS does when it enters into an area is do what? Start providing bread for the people. All of a sudden, they become popular within that society. Their ideology was falling on deaf ears, and that's why they rely on these other ways to promote themselves. But for some reason, we can't seem to understand this. And so we, as a nation, in terms of our foreign policy, we think it is purely an intellectual, or we just say what is, our position is stronger than the other, and we're going to defeat it. No, it requires that we should shift our emphasis, because at the end of the day, we're not really, or we shouldn't be, about winning people's minds, winning the argument. If we're gonna have any success in this fight, it's going to be about winning people's hearts. And that's not going to be done through either through force or through necessarily even intellectual argumentation. And so this comes to now in the Muslim context or with the Muslim response. You know, one of the, the end of last year, over 200 so Muslim scholars from around the world, extremely broad-based, different theologies, different schools of thought, signed an open letter to al-Baghdadi, outlining his irrelevance in his positions in terms of Islamic tradition, Islamic history, etc., Islamic law, that the basis of his claims and his actions, going through a very detailed letter to him, is baseless, has no basis. Now, is this going to convince Baghdadi? No, it's not. And if it stays in that realm, which to some degree, I believe it has, because I find people even in my own local community, many people not even aware of it, because it was not promoted in the ways that ISIS, for example, uses to promote things. And so it's not actually, yes, those statements need to be issued, but it has to be beyond the statement. Because it has to be dispersed through those other people in society who are not ideologically bent. That at least they can then have the question in their mind when they're hearing something else. But it has to be countered. You know, just 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting with Homeland Security discussing Muslim radicalization in the United States. And it was very interesting how they were going through basically the effective use that Shabab and ISIS, etc., is using on social media, and all of the responses by Muslim moderate scholars, etc., not addressing one of those social media techniques. So it has to be dispersed. We have to use, those who are involved in this have to move those things and respond in the way in which they are using the recruiting, targeting those areas. In dealing with the local communities overseas, targeting there and targeting that's taking place. And I you know, this is something that I've seen personally sometimes, that there's oftentimes in the U.S. government a lot of wasted, I think, money and resources in spite of these outreach programs we do to different parts of the world. And it is oftentimes, I find, because we choose to ignore those in the society that have sustained, or those institutes in society that have sustained those societies for generations. And those oftentimes are the religious institutions. And so we go in and we engage people who have similar minds like us, which is important. But we don't want to have the difficult conversations with those who don't. Never mind, obviously, dealing with those who are, have bounties on their head. So we go into communities or societies, we ignore the local imams, we ignore the local mosques. These are religious societies. What have you done? Instead of empowering that local imam who has over his congregation, and giving him authority, who has authority in his congregation, you actually disempower him. He views you as a threat, and therefore he moves towards more extremist ideology. Right, he's not, and I'm telling you this from my experience, and Imam Majid obviously has been dealing with this much more. Imams are not generally hardcore ideologically bent. They are human beings. It is behavior. They're concerned about their future, their authority, their power, whatever it is. But if you go in and you undermine that, then you've made an enemy. So rather than marginalizing these people who could be your friends, you should be empowering them. Now, this also requires that the religious institutions themselves should be doing this in these countries, which they unfortunately fail at this as well. But having them actually empower these local imams, giving them the training, etc. I'm sure if you go across the Muslim world, you will find many, most imams that don't have any idea of probably even their own muftis in their countries and their statements when the signing of this, for example, 40-page letter to al-Baghdadi of his positions. But they know about al-Baghdadi's positions, right? Because they hasn't been taken down even to that level. So don't overlook those institutions that obviously have been in operation and have been sustaining the community for generations, right? Since the beginning of time. Religious institutions have always been at the core of cultures and peoples. This also goes also for social structures, tribal structures, right? A lot of these, you know, in Yemen and other areas in Afghanistan, we are dealing with tribal society. So even if they have a facade of a modern nation state, you are actually dealing still with tribal societies. And we can't overlook that and marginalize these people because maybe they don't have official heads within their governments or what have you, but actually hold the power. Right, or hold a significant amount of power in their societies. Again, if you treat them as human beings, human beings behave in similar ways pursuant to impetus, stimuli that is given to them. The final thing I just wanted to touch on in terms of just locally here, I think that we can try to work more toward, and this is more what I'm concerned with, because this is more of my sphere of influence, is bringing really consciousness of this drones issue to the grassroots level, right? And this is, and I'm, you know, I put myself first. I'm not excusing myself from this. My failings to do so in my own community. But I think that we should move toward this, that bringing this issue, that it's principally wrong, that it's morally wrong, taking in our sermons, etc. What we can do. Two things. One, in terms of working toward, and this is a great project here, this conference, and this will hopefully will emerge into something else, national organizations, as they did with NERCAT, you know, taking upon the stance that this is unacceptable, etc. But moving beyond that in terms of also making sure it gets trickled down to the local communities. Drones are so far removed from our consciousness because we don't see the impact, right? You don't see the impact for us as a nation. And I think that's, you know, one of the problems of it is you the real impact, you know, when we start seeing body bags of our own coming back home, all of a sudden it's in everybody's consciousness that what are we doing overseas? Nobody's asking that question because there's no direct impact they're seeing, right? And unfortunately, the damage that's being done over there, the impact is so tremendous. And then, you know, when there's drastic responses, many people asking the questions why. But drones have made warfare so far removed from those who are utilizing them against others. So the importance of bringing it to the local level. But the additional remark I would just make on this, that if and when this is done on a more systematic level, that the promotion of this can not only be for our community, but for the international community. Muslims and others in these areas, they need to know that there are religious groupings in America, that there's religious establishment in America, right? Are against some of these tactics, because then at least they are aware of that, and it stops this generalization that they have of what Americans think and the ignorance that they have about our society and our culture of how we operate. But we need to make sure that we promote this internationally and make it known to them, and, you know, doing it in different languages, etc. This sort of thing, that it becomes at least accessible for them. Thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to the discussion.